On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Microsoft steps up its Windows 10 nag game, the FTC goes after PCI compliance, and Splunk shows us how it's done. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 180, recorded March 11th, 2016. Splunk. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Atlassian. Unleash your team's potential with collaborative software tools like HipChat and Jira, which will enable you to work and communicate better together. Visit Atlassian.com to learn more. And by Drobo, a family of safe and expandable yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit Drobo.com/twit and use the code TWIT100 to save $100 on select models, including the new B810i. And by Citrix GoToWebinar. Connect and convert qualified leads with GoToWebinar, the leading platform for engaging online events. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToWebinar.com today. Welcome to TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I'm joined by my regular cohorts, my cast of characters, my co-hosts, my good friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, and he is holding up a 3D-printed 120-decibel whistle thing. Wow. Okay, T-Bird, other than lame whistles, what's going on with you?
Thanks, Frankie Hippo. I really appreciate it. No, I'm boning up on some new IoT middleware that's starting to arrive, and we're going to be showing it off at the Interop trade show.
Oh, very nice. Yes, we've got a reason to head back to Vegas in May. Of course, it's not just T-Bird. We've got that rotating co-host schedule, and on the schedule today is Mr. Lou Maresca. He is a senior development lead with Microsoft, specifically in their Dynamics department. Lou, how is the great, what is that, Northwest treating you?
Pacific Northwest. Yeah, you're doing great. Sunny today, and Brian mentioned, I'm actually building my own middleware for IoT on some Node.js, so that's what I'm working on today. Some fun stuff.
Yeah, so it'll be the Internet of Lou. Wait for it. Well, gentlemen, we've got a great episode. We're bringing in the Splunkers. They were big data before big data was big data. And they're going to show you why you need their tool and why you might want to consider what they have to say about containers. But before we do that, let's go ahead and jump straight into the blips. This first one, well, if malware downloads Windows 10 in a forest, does anyone hear it? You, sir, have become an expert at avoiding Windows 10. You know how to remove GWX.exe from your system and to keep it off. You've memorized the dozens of updates that re-add the oh-so-helpful reminder to your boot process. You are a ninja at keeping Microsoft Nagware off your system, but you ain't ready for Microsoft's latest Windows 10 game. It's inside an essential security patch. Patch KB3139929 fixes a potential remote execution exploit in Internet Explorer and is therefore an essential patch for anyone using IE. But if you read the fine print, you'll see the following. Quote, this security update resolves several reported vulnerabilities in Internet Explorer. The most severe of these vulnerabilities could allow remote code execution if a user views a specially crafted web page in Internet Explorer. Additionally, the security update includes several non-security related fixes for IE. Unquote. The non-security fixes? You guessed it, a Windows 10 nag screen that comes up when you open a new IE tab on a non-domain join machine.
Skype co-founder launches ultra-private messaging with video. Skype's Danish co-founder Janus Fries gathered a set of 50 engineers, some previous Skype technologists, to bring to market a new secured platform for text, voice, video, and media. The Swiss-based startup called Wire is a set of applications across multiple application platforms that allow for easy communication that is encrypted end-to-end. Conversations can be one-on-one in groups and are available across multiple devices and platforms. Wire relies on standard open source encryption techniques, which allows for outside technical experts to evaluate the security of its products rather than relying on its trust. And Wire also claims no ads, no profiling or selling user data, and claims to be able to do HD video even though the stream is secured. Text messages and pictures use off-the-record OTR and encryption. Wire uses the Axolotl ratchet and pre-keys, which are optimized for mobile messaging where key exchange happens asynchronously. Voice calls use the WebRTC standard, where DTLS is used for key negotiation and authentication, and SRTP is used for encrypted media transport. This platform seems to hold some serious promise, and their privacy website has some interesting comparisons among some of the big key players.
Apple gets smacked with a $450 million ebook price-fixing fine. The only folks happy with this decision is Amazon, and the ramifications are spreading throughout the publishing industry. The gist is the Supreme Court found Apple guilty of conspiring with five publishers in a price-fixing scheme. While I applaud the decision, I'm also waiting for the other shoe to drop, like Barnes & Noble shuttering their European ebook business recently and curtailing their American app and video stores. What this really means is less choices and one more step to what may become a de facto monopoly in book distribution.
Now, over a year ago, the FCC served notice that hotels and convention centers were not allowed to block Wi-Fi hotspots. The practice becomes commonplace in the marketplace where hotel and convention center internet connectivity is big business, and ubiquitous Wi-Fi hotspots threaten to cut into that cash cow. After a few high-profile cases, specifically a $600,000 fine levied against Marriott in late 2014, the FCC made it clear that it was not kosher to attack the unlicensed Wi-Fi spectrum in an effort to push users to in-house connectivity. Done. Finished. All good, right? Nope. There have been dozens of complaints submitted to the FCC about Hilton, Sheraton, Motel 6, and other major chains who seem to be continuing the practice of de-authing unauthorized Wi-Fi hotspots. Furthermore, we're only hearing from those who are annoyed enough to file a complaint. The numbers suggest that the practice is not just widespread, but that the FCC fine has done little to deter. With the FCC lacking the manpower to enforce their policy, there can be just one piece of advice to business travelers. Turn off the Wi-Fi and tether via a wired option.
The world's thinnest lens. Researchers from Australian National University have discovered the world's thinnest lens. It's made of molybdenum disulfide, which is where a single layer is 0.7 nanometers thick. This will be one of the first manufactured materials to manipulate light at an atomic scale. Sounds like something from Star Trek. This lens is 1/2000th of the thickness of a human hair. The 6.3 nanometer lens, or 9 atomic layers, outshines previous ultra-flat lenses, which were previously made from a 50 nanometer thick gold bar nanobar array known as metamaterial. This new material is able to survive at high temperatures, is a lubricant and a good semiconductor, and can even emit photons. The process by which the manufacturer lens is by using a 10 micron radius lens, using a focused ion beam to shave off layers of atom by atom until the dome shape of the lens appears. This opens the door to such applications for better manufacturing of thin flexible displays and more precise mobile phone cameras and much more.
The next net neutrality battleground is data collection and how you define privacy. While the FCC played the Title II nuclear option and is now dropping the other shoe, Article 222 is now being brought up, and this section involves every telecommunication carrier has the duty to protect the confidentiality of proprietary information of and relating to customers. So now ISPs are tasting the same kind of regulations that common carriers have had to deal with over the years, and are actually making an effort to protect the privacy of their customers. This doesn't sound like the end of targeted ads, but it sure sounds like the world is going to change.
We've been saying for almost 2 years now here on This Week in Enterprise Tech that the new battleground for the enterprise network is happening far away from the sophisticated software, expensive hardware, and expert eyes of big-ticket enterprise security deployments. After all, who needs to breach the core when you can own the edge? Well, yesterday, the edge got just a little scarier. Cisco Systems released an update for their DPC-2203 and EPC-2203 cable modems with digital voice, patching a high-impact vulnerability in the popular residential gateway. The vulnerability stemmed from the embedded web server, which could be exploited with a HTTP request to perform arbitrary code execution that could lead to the disclosure of sensitive information. Specifically, an attacker could see behind the NAT, capture all the ISP settings, and otherwise have visibility into the attached network. Customers with the gateways are advised to contact their service providers to ensure that their software patch has been received. Well, that does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to be jumping into the bites. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, behind every great human achievement is a great team. Genome mapping, 3D printing, space exploration, renewable energy, the next great app, or the next great charity. All of those endeavors live and die by their ability to tap into the skills and the inspiration of their team members. So, how do you bring everyone together and build what's next? Well, with Atlassian, of course. Now, we've been using Atlassian here at Twit as a vital piece of our creative process. Our engineering team uses Confluence to document equipment and work processes. We use Jira for managing vendors and organizing our constantly growing pile of tasks, which would otherwise be overwhelming. HipChat ties together everything from event planning to DevOps to interdepartment communication. Now, with Jira, we get clear and concise flows of task management, allowing us to see exactly who was assigned, what, and when. With Confluence, we can share content and ideas on a timeline that lets anyone on the team see where the project is going over time. That's great when you need to bring in new team members and you have to bring them up to speed. With HipChat, we can communicate in real time with IM or video on any of our devices. And of course, Bitbucket lets us test, review, comment, and manage our code in real time. From startup to 10,000-seat enterprise, Atlassian makes great ideas real. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to go to Atlassian.com to learn more and to see how Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket gives your team everything you need to organize, discuss, and complete your shared work. That's Atlassian.com. Again, Atlassian.com. Unleash the potential in your team and build what's next. And we thank Atlassian for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. This is sort of a story that seems to rise up every 8 or 9 months or so, typically when there's a breach of a major retailer. But now looks like the FTC is getting serious about PCI DSS compliance, or specifically, they're getting real about whether or not it does the job. Now, who would have thunk it? But it seems that self-policing of the companies responsible for keeping our financial transaction data is not the best idea when literally billions of dollars are at stake. The FTC has decided that it will be going after payment processors, specifically if the PCI DSS compliance procedure is actually securing networks and keeping consumers safe. Right now, they're going after 9 companies that range from the very, very big to the very, very small. They include PricewaterhouseCoopers, Mandiant, Foresight MSP, Freed Maxic, Verizon Enterprise Solutions, Security Metrics, NDB, GuidePoint, and Sword and Shield Enterprise Security. Now, the FTC will be looking for PCI compliance as well as charges of excessive charges on credit cards, inconsistent enforcement of recommendations, and rampant conflict of interest. Now, for us enterprise folks, the one that is most interesting is the conflict of interest. Specifically, the FTC is looking at the fact that the QSAs, those are the qualified security assessors that make money doing those security assessments, are then allowed to sell software, hardware, and services that they can certify as PCI compliant. In other words, it's like having the contractor and the subcontractor and the inspector all be the same person. Evidently, that's not a good idea. Now, before we get too much into this, Chibrit, we've talked about this before. Exactly what is PCI DSS?
All PCI is just a set of rules, just like HIPAA or FERPA or Sarbanes-Oxley. And it's just the wishful thinking of bureaucrats to say that, gee, it's going to be, you know, here's a set of rules and go for it. You know, it's basically payment card industries data security standard. All it is a set of rules. And my biggest problem with them is that, like HIPAA, like FERPA, like Sarbanes-Oxley, they don't really go into detail. And so, you know, we can talk about this more as we go into the requirements, but the reality is a lot of people have different interpretations, and the different interpretations in the past, especially because the contractors, the auditors, and so forth have been the same organizations, have been weak, to say the least.
All right. Now, something else to consider when we're talking about PCI DSS is, again, there are 12 requirements that fit with, I think it's 5 control objectives. And it covers everything from installing and maintaining a proper firewall to implementing and maintaining proper security policy. So it's literally from the hardware to the person who is inputting data into the hardware. It sounds good. If you were to look up what the PCI DSS requirements are, they are pretty good. Installing and maintaining the firewall, not using vendor supplied defaults for system passwords and other security parameters, protecting stored cardholder data, encrypting transmissions of cardholder data across public open networks, all the way up to tracking and monitoring all access to network resources and cardholder data. If you were to look down those requirements, they are a nice little checkbox of what you would expect from a security audit on any enterprise network.
I beg to differ on one thing, though, Padre. You said proper firewall. No such word exists in that rule. I've looked at that ruling many, many times.
That's true. That's true.
And a lot of restaurants, especially, are using El Cheapo, Linksys, or Netgear firewalls, the same ones that are running like half a decade old copies of Linux. But it's a firewall, and it's compliant.
That's right. That's right. We'll get back to what it means to be compliant in just a bit. I want to bring Lou in here. Lou, you work with Microsoft Dynamics. You do CRM. You've seen what kind of hardware your clients will run on. And it's interesting when you bring the financial aspect into it, because all of a sudden a network that might have been good enough to do internal semi-sensitive information is not good at all when you start doing transactional data over. Have you dealt with this at all in the dynamic side?
Absolutely. I think a lot of corporations that try to implement this too, especially who take payments and so on, is they think that the vendors that they're using are going to make them secure. Again, that's like, you know, something that's not, most vendors don't even handle any of those 12 requirements, no, or not at least all of them at least. Another thing is people think that if I'm PCI compliant, I'm going to be secure too. And as Brian pointed out, that's totally untrue. It might be get you closer. It's basically those 12 requirements have some very simple and standard results for you to kind of secure your network in a way, but does it make it 100% secure? No, it's just, they're just guidelines they want you to follow to be compliant. They don't get you beyond that. So we do see that a lot is when companies or corporations implement these things, they tend to go just on the guide and that's it. That's where they stop. And so that's where you kind of risk a bunch of possible breaches in areas for people to attack.
Right, right. Let's dive a little bit deeper into this, because it's very easy to get caught up in, well, is the FTC overreaching here? Exactly what are they asking for? Are these payment processors actually doing a bad thing in trying to meet these PCI DSS requirements? Let's look at the issue that you can read into all of the documents that have been released so far. There is the conflict of interest issue, which we've already talked about, which is putting the same entity in charge of building the system and certifying whether or not it's secure. But the other issue is this idea of self-policing. The FTC is going after a self-policing process that right now allows the QSAs to make a list of recommendations in order to become PCI DSS compliant. But then there is no process of actually seeing if the vendor, if the retailer, if whoever's doing the payment processing has acted upon those requirements. In fact, right now, the way that it works is, for example, let's say I've given you a list. I'm the QSA, and I give you a list of things that you should do in order to meet the PCI compliance. When I come back, I don't actually look at your network to see if you've made those changes. I ask you, have you made those changes? And if you say yes, I check off and I say you are now PCI DSS compliant. So the FTC is looking at that and saying that's all kinds of wrong. There should be at least a little bit of accountability on whether or not you've acted on the recommendations that have been made to you to protect consumer data. Chibert, give me the other side. What's the other side here that would have people saying, I don't want too much government oversight. I don't want the FTC stepping in because they'll just muck it up.
This is another case of the government has tried to stay out. I've heard all kinds of conversations about this. They kept saying, you know, you guys need to do more. You need to do more. And I'm sorry, you know, I'm on one side of the fence in that the credit card industry was supposed to have chip and PIN. They only did chip and sign. And they really haven't done enough to protect the consumer. What the FTC is saying is to the credit card industry is, hey, guys, you've been given free rein. You've had this rope. You've said you're going to do something, but yet you do these half measures. and we can't trust you anymore. So we're what they are saying is we're going to put you in line because you can't do it yourself. And that's really what these guys are saying, that, hey, you've had these regulations, you had this checklist, you had these measures, but they've been weak. So get your act together.
Okay. Okay. See that. And Lou, let me pull you in here because, I mean, I get it. It's very easy for me to look at what's going on and say, wow, this is stupid. This is ridiculous. Why is this being allowed? But at the same time, it's not as if FTC oversight is going to automatically guarantee that suddenly it's going to be run well. I mean, FTC had plenty of oversight of Wall Street. That didn't turn out so great. One of the issues, and again, let's go back to the conflict of interest, is that the QSAs, they get paid, but the way that they get paid is not by doing the assessment. They get paid by selling the hardware, and that's actually built into the structure. So people are looking at the PCI DSS, and they're saying the issue isn't that it's not being used properly. The issue is that it was written broken. You can't have the same people who are selling you the security hardware be the ones to tell you that the security hardware is good enough. Those should be independent entities. Can you make a cogent reason for them to continue self-policing?
I don't think so. I think the problem is there's no way to go back and re-audit all this stuff. So, I mean, it doesn't matter if they change the compliances and get in there and they, you know, they do away with maybe being self-assessment and so on. There's no way for them to come back and do this feedback loop over and over again to make sure that they stay compliant. So I don't think there's really a way for them to make this better in that sense.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's what I'm looking about. And the chat room is having a really good discussion, including with our Spunk Ninja, about regulators. Regulators tend to be a trigger word. It's a really, really bad, visceral body response of, well, great, now we're adding yet another layer of bureaucracy. But again, the way that the current PCI DSS regulations are enforced is with that conflict of interest. And that's not a mistake. That's how it was created. I don't see a way to get around it other than getting rid of that mechanism, at least splitting up the mechanism so that the assessors get paid and the hardware slash services slash software vendors get paid, but they get paid independently. That's one way to make sure that the assessors become good assessors, because if you're a bad assessor, you don't keep your job, and to make sure that vendors become good vendors, because if you're not a good vendor, you don't keep your job. Right now, because they're meshed, it's kind of like a big mafia family of PCI auditing. Chibert, we're going to come back to this. Hopefully, we can come back to this with Oliver, because Oliver is just loves to talk about PCI DSS. Do you have any last words about this? If we've got IT people out there who are helping to secure financial transaction networks, what should they be paying attention to in this PCI DSS debate?
Perimeter firewalls are dead. For God's sakes, put in at least some zones and separate your functions. It's not hard to do, but every single POS vendor that I have dealt with in the last 5 years thinks perimeter is the cat's ass.
Oh, that might be the show title. Thanks, T-Bert. Now, when we come back, we've got something exciting plan for you. Imagine, if you will, that you have some sort of software, some sort of hardware in your data center, in your data closet, in your enterprise network, in your small to medium business network that would allow you not to just look forward and backward in time, but to dig through events on your network as if they were happening right then. Well, folks, we got it. It's called Splunk. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and it's Drobo. Now, if you run a business, then you know this. You know that your digital data is not something that's nice. It's something that your business runs on. You can't run without it. Other than your people, your data is the single most important asset that you have. So why, in this day and age, are people not making sure that their storage reflects the importance of that data? That's why we're happy to have Drobo as a sponsor of the Twilight Riot. Drobo is the safe, simple, and expandable solution for all your storage needs, offering not just a solution, but an entire family of external storage arrays for the end user, the small to medium business, and the enterprise. I want to talk a little bit about the Drobo B810i. It's an 8-bay iSCSI SAN with data-aware tiering that offers storage capabilities usually found in much more expensive enterprise solutions. It features data-aware tiering, which means it automatically prioritizes frequently used transactional data above store data that's seldom used. This enables businesses to consolidate storage resources and share that storage across all connected clients and their applications without sacrificing speed. It also lets you access both physical and virtual storage in a single array and lets you scale either on demand to maximize capacity, performance as needed. With smart volumes, you can create up to 255 individual drives with a maximum capacity of 64 terabytes each, provisioning each as necessary. No more guessing on how big to make each volume. You can use their dual iSCSI ports for up to 2x gigabit Ethernet performance when you use MPIO in a Microsoft environment. You can use it for collaboration, for testing, for development, for backup, running Microsoft Exchange, or more. It's perfect for small to medium businesses that don't have dedicated IT support. Now, we've been using Drobo here at the Brick House since it was the cottage. In fact, it's the array that Leo carries with him when he shuttles data back and forth between the studio and his home. We like it because Drobo understands that you build a storage array for a particular use, for a particular mission. It's not one size fits all. They've got gigabit connected for those who need network-attached storage. They've got USB 3 and Thunderbolt for people who just want a lot of really fast storage on their local computer. Folks, we love Drobo, and we know you will too. They're reliable. Data received by your Drobo not yet written to disk is protected if there's a sudden power loss. Even better, Drobos have an internal eUSB device where data is copied if there's a power failure to protect you against those long outages. It's expandable, and you can add or replace drives in your Drobo with ease. No tools are required. And it's fast. With its support of iSCSI, Ethernet, and USB 3, well, you get the speed that you need. We want you to visit Drobo.com/twit to learn more about the Drobo B810i and to check out their complete line of products. Also, when you order a B810i between now and April 30th, you'll get two free 2-terabyte hard drives included. Plus, when you use the code TWIT100, you'll save $100 off the purchase of any B810i or other Drobo model. Folks, give it a try. That's Drobo.com/twit. Drobo.com/twit. And we thank Drobo for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to my favorite part of the show. It's when we bring in our guest experts who get to tell us a little something-something about what's going on in the enterprise world. And today, it's not just one guest or two guests. It's three guests. We've got Clint Sharp sitting next to me in the studio. He is the product manager, Splunk IT Service Intelligence. We've got Michael Wild, also known as the Key Poses of Yoga Wildman.
What?
He's the chief of Black Ops and White Lies, the Office of Field Technology at Splunk, which is, it is that crazy of a company. And Hal Rottenberg, he is the Lorax, the Office of the CTO, again, at Splunk. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Oh, it's awesome to be here.
My pleasure.
Now, I go back with Wildman. We're both part of the Interop team for many, many years. In fact, I have many collectible Splunk t-shirts, some with phrases that we can't actually put on the stream because we're family friendly.
You can.
Yeah.
They're still safe.
They're still safe. But any of you, for the folks who are sitting at home and maybe have heard of Splunk, probably when it was being described as sort of a meteoric rise. You've been a Wall Street darling for quite a while now. What is Splunk?
Splunk's an engine for data. And what makes it so incredibly powerful is IT people have a ton of questions they have to ask and answer every single day in their jobs. And I did it for 10 years before I came to Splunk. So before I was a vendor, I was a user. And they have to answer questions like, who's logging into my systems right now? What's the average response time of these systems? What could be going wrong? What errors am I seeing? And those questions require a ton of data. And they don't have control over that data. They don't have time to build a whole business intelligence system to answer these types of questions. They want to just throw data at a solution, be able to ask and answer any question of that data to be able to troubleshoot and operate their systems. And that's what we do.
Wildman. Interesting note here, and that is when we started This Week at Enterprise Tech, I think it was probably episode 4 when we started talking about big data and Hadoop, and it was just starting to be a big thing. By the end of year 1 of this program, everyone had a big data product, and everyone was trying to get into the big data market. But as I was looking at what it dealt with and how it worked, I realized, oh, I saw this 3 years ago with Splunk. At Interop, I mean, that's essentially what you do. You make something intelligent out of all the disparate data that was flowing through a network.
Yeah, and we, you know, even back then when we used to work at Interop together, you know, one of the big parts is we actually have a tool that's pretty darn usable. So if you, you know, employ a big data system, there's a lot you actually have to build on top of it, like to get visualizations and, maybe a search language to find something and a way to aggregate and do statistics. And right out of the box, the very same product that you can download today and that you could download almost 10 years ago is the product that customers are doing multiple terabytes a day on a daily basis and solving some really interesting things. We were chatting yesterday, I think in email, and I said to Chi, have you ever had a Coke Freestyle machine? You ever been to one of those?
I don't think so, no.
Have you not seen this machine?
I have not.
Oh, they're crazy.
Oh, come on. They are rather cool, actually.
Okay.
My daughter loves them. You can do anything with them.
A Coke Freestyle machine?
Yeah, you remember like the suicide that you used to make when you were four, you know, and you would go up and just kind of do this? Well, now you have a little screen. You can make whatever you want. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think I've seen one at the Atlanta airport. I think that's the only time I've ever seen one of those.
Okay, so here's the deal. This is one of Coke's biggest things, and they built it's a fountain, right? So you'd find it at a vendor. Like, let's say you were at Schlotzky's or Wendy's or something like that. I'm sure you're there all the time. Okay. And instead of the six flavors of Coke or Coke products or nine, there's this cool touch screen. There's somebody's got it on the screen on YouTube, and you basically choose your base flavors and there you go. And there is an app too. So you can save your flavors on your app. And when you walk into a vendor that has a Freestyle machine, you basically point the camera at the QR code and it will send your flavors to it and vend it for you, which is cool. So I like make my own little crazy one. Every time you press the vend button, or it's called fill, like 100 bytes a day to get sent back to a data center that goes into Splunk. And if you think about it, Coke goes back. We went back from, like Clint said, figuring out who's logging in your machine, doing grep on steroids, to now doing consumption analytics, troubleshooting, and even business intelligence on what flavors people are using, when they're out, how they can, you know, what they want to drink. And all of that stuff is really just the exhaust that comes from machines, and that really becomes an insane amount of big data. And you know, it's a fun place to be and a great product to represent. So,
Michael, what kind of intelligence do you get out of that? I mean, yes, it's very cool. I love the idea of consolidating information from disparate sources, mm-hmm. but yeah, it can give me consumption data. It can let me know what flavors are most popular. It can let me know if flavors tend to sort of group based on geography. But mm-hmm. what else? What else do you get from collecting all of that?
Yeah, I mean, in that particular use case, they're machines and the machines break, right? Being alerted on when, let's say, maybe certain lines are having trouble, certain flavors are going out more than others, maybe a vendor or a merchant isn't replacing them fast enough. There's a bunch of other use cases that are out there for them. I mean, there's another cool use case. There's two really cool ones. New York Air Brake. You'd probably never heard of them, but they make the train braking systems. Question, what happens if you brake a train too late?
Bad things.
That's bad. What happens if you brake a train too early, right? If the train operator hits the brake too early?
Also bad things.
It's bad. It doesn't cost anybody their lives, but it costs massive amounts of fuel. And the guys at New York Air Brake take data off of the systems that run the trains and help. They do a bunch of crazy analytics on them with Splunk, and it helps the train operators do a more optimal braking. Really cool stuff. Something you might like. A company in Japan manages like 1,000 office buildings. They take the data from the elevators when you go up and down and the card swipes from all the suites. At that point in time, they're omnipotent, and they can pretty much predict whether somebody is going to renew their lease or not.
Oh, right. That's Krups. Yeah, that we cover those machines on the show, Krups. They make some new black boxes. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the amount of intelligence is cool. Like, just whether it's trying to find something wrong or doing predictive analytics or crazy machine learning, we've really tried to build a platform that you can pretty much start to do anything with and all of that. You know, we're not even close to being where we want it to be. But Clint can show you some awesome stuff, right. I think.
One of my favorite things is I'm a Comcast customer, like probably most people in the area, and I have the does anybody have their new X1 DVR sort of thing? It's pretty cool. I mean, you can browse around all your channels and all that sort of stuff, right? And so as you do that, every piece of that data, every time you change the channel, that ends up in Splunk. And as they rolled out that system, it's a complicated system of many different APIs that are called, many different things that interplay, and they use Splunk to help them optimize the customer experience. So they were able to take channel change times and start to drive them down, figure out what channels people were watching and why. And so it's that type of data is useful for tons and tons of different use cases.
Now, in just a bit, Clint, I'm going to ask you to show us. You've got the client on your computer, so you can show some Splunk magic. But before we do that, I want to bring Hal into the conversation. Hal.
Hello, Father.
This is great. I mean, this is the sort of thing that I expect to hear from Michael. He has been an evangelist from day one. The first time I met him, he was selling me on Splunk. And then he got Cheebert to use Splunk for all the analytic tools that they use at the school of, is it Noah? We'll talk to Cheebert in just a bit. But when you talk to an executive and you try to tell them that they need your solution, how do you differentiate it from everything else? Because I could hear in the back of my head, because I'm a little insane, executives saying, you're just collecting data, right? I mean, I could use anything. Why would I need to buy a Splunk solution to take this information and to turn it into actionable information?
Well, it is just data, but it is also any kind of data. So there's all kinds of think about there's basically value being left on the floor. If you don't collect that data, organize it in such a way that you can then query it, produce visualizations based on it, really cool advanced stuff like predictive analytics and anomaly detection, and using Splunk as a platform to kind of hook things up with it, other pieces of your infrastructure through APIs and SDKs, and really using Splunk as part of the glue that binds all these things together. A lot of people use us as a manager of managers, for example, to really get the highest level oversight. But at the same time, the tool is used as self-service for everybody in the, you know, the line of business, in the IT service desk, and so forth.
Okay, let's get to the moment that we've been waiting for. We've talked about it enough. Clint, you've got magic. Show me some magic.
Let's do magic. I love magic.
Splunk magic.
Splunk magic.
All right, so what am I looking at right now?
So you're looking at our search screen, and this is how we got started, which was think of us as like SuperGrep or Google for the data center, right? Throw all your logs at us, and for the most part, this experience looks pretty similar to the experience you may have seen years ago. But it's important to start there because it helps to understand how we think about data. So I can start with simple things like maybe I want to search for error, and you can see that that's comes back pretty fast. We're really good at finding needles in haystacks, you know, rare events, and you can see that we're very good at doing things that are multi-line. So if you've ever tried to use, you know, your standard Unix tool chain, grep and tail and things like that to look at multi-line events, it's complicated. Multi-line things are hard. We're very good at understanding differing structures of data. But also, most importantly, we're very good at separating signal from noise and pulling structure out of that unstructured data. So when you look at sort of this sea of data, we have things like a timestamp. We extract a timestamp. So we have time as a first-class citizen in the product. You can use Splunk to find anything over time. But we're also very good at extracting structure out of this data. So things like SQL state. This is a field that we've discovered out of the sea of data that's in there. And things like rack and row. And so we pull that structure out of that unstructured data. And that allows us to do things like ad hoc analytics. So I can say, let's look at something more like a web log. And so web logs are, again, pretty structured data. Has a timestamp, has a lot of information in that weblog. But I can start to do things and look for, as I see on the left-hand side, I have a lot of categories and fields that we've discovered in that data. And similar to what you might think about like a database, they have lots of columns and rows and fields. I can do things like give me a report of the top values. And this is where you start to see the power of the tool.
Okay, there we go.
So I've gone from a sea of data, right? And I've structured that data. I pulled that structure out as I'm reading the data off of disk. So I didn't have to know anything about this data in advance. I just poured it all into the system. And all we did was extract timestamps, break it up into events, and then we can start to do ad hoc analytics right on the fly. So right here, I'm saying something like top, but I can also very quickly say, let's do a time chart and let's count that by source type and let's relay this out more like a line chart instead. And so if you've ever used any type of analytics tool and you've tried to do something simple, like just take this table and put it out over time, how incredibly complicated was that in the tools that you used? And as we take that sea of data, we start layering upon top of that, right? And so what we've been working on recently is what we call IT service intelligence. So we take that sea of data, and we start to put a service lens on top of that sea of data. And that service lens allows us to start thinking of things like, maybe this is my web service, or maybe this is my my mobile service or my middleware service. And we break that up into key performance indicators. So any of that sea of data that we're taking at, any number that we can extract, any field that we can extract, we start to think of those as key performance indicators.
And this is all drillable, right? So let's say I find an event. Mm-hmm. I can drill down to it and actually see what services, what packets, what clients we're talking.
Yeah, so we have a thing that we like to say at Splunk, which is no raw data should ever be harmed.
Okay, right.
So in a lot of systems, in order to get the data into the analytical tool, we have to massage it, and we lose resolution of that data over time, right? As I take and I massage that data to get it into a table and get it into a database, well, I have to kind of throw away some of that stuff because it didn't fit into the database, right? It didn't fit into that design that I had. But in Splunk, we store everything raw and we extract it at search time. So we can always get back to that raw data, right? And so
non-destructive analytics.
Non-destructive, right? Okay. Except think of it like, yeah, more like a more like non-destructive compression, right? Like we're not actually losing any information as we're looking at it, right? And so with ITSI, we put that service lens on top of it, but then we had this really cool user story where, you know, imagine you're a complicated IT shop and you've got all of this software. You have your network infrastructure, you have your server infrastructure, and then you have your applications that are riding on top of all of that. And it's difficult to look at all of that infrastructure and put it in context to something that means something for someone. And for that, we knew that they had a lot of access to diagrams internally, things like Visio diagrams that they had drawn. And what if I could just take something like that Visio diagram and just start to take all this data that's like feeding around, all this exhaust that's being given off by these machines, and start to overlay it on top of those diagrams? And for that, we built Glass Table, right? Because, you know, what if I could just go in and draw a whiteboard, take a picture of it with my camera, upload it, and start throwing stuff on top of that?
So, okay.
So for this kind of idea, so here I'm going to click edit. I can take and I can draw literally, you know, right on top of my dashboard. Right, start to position it. I can set things like color, and I can make it purple because purple is the best color for dashboards. and then I can start to overlay, you know, some text on top of here because I may know like this is some, you know, sample text, and I can make it, you know, Comic Sans because that's the best font. And I can do things like overlay my health score. So one of the key things we do in IT service intelligence is we build these services in KPIs.
And oh, I like this.
Yeah. We start to calculate a score of health for your given service. Again, and it can be any data. That's the whole – based off that core platform, any data. And we calculate a score from 0 to 100 of what the health of that service is based off of all these key performance indicators. And even best for all those key performance indicators, you don't have to know what's normal for that given set of data. We'll use our adaptive thresholding and anomaly detection algorithms to go back and look at that data and help you understand what's normal about that data so you don't even have to know anything about that data in advance.
P.S. Chops in our chat room says that, you know, this is hard data, which makes IT geeks very happy. But you could also, with the Glass Table, you can have that nice, very simple to understand flow chart for the execs and say, this is what's happening on the network. And if you need me to explain the data, you can click this and you'll understand nothing.
Yes. And so one of the things that I used to run IT operations before I came to Splunk, and you know, sort of the dreaded outage bridge where everybody has to get together and things aren't working and people are yelling and there's lots of yelling. And then, you know, your management team is yelling at you and saying, fix, 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 right? And you want to be able to give them that status. So you can build a glass table just for your boss, like, here, boss, go away. Like, you go work on, you just look at that. And when it turns green, then you'll be fine, right? Just and then don't call me back. But for everybody else, what if we wanted to be able to look at all that data at once, right? So we wanted to give people a really dense view into all that data. And for that, we built Deep Dive. And Deep Dive is a very dense time series view on that information. And so that I can take all of these KPIs, so I can navigate around the hierarchy of services that I have, and I can see these KPIs and I can add them to my Deep Dives. And this gives me an incredibly dense view on that information, because what we saw people doing when they were running these outage bridges is they would have all their tools open, right? You know, they'd have five or six views on different data, a network tool and a database tool and things like that. And they'd be rearranging their browser windows to try to fit you know, everything on one screen. And we wanted to be able to get them everything together. So you can do things like drag and drop and narrow in. You can compare to things like yesterday and look over different time windows. And so we give you an idea based off of these kind of colorings as to what the status was at that given time period. And again, all based off of any data. You can feed us any data at any time. And so we've started to layer upon this technology now that gives people all kinds of different views into their data. And we're showing you primarily the IT side, but from a security side, we're incredibly popular as well. We have a product called Enterprise Security that does the same thing for your security type of posture. You guys were talking about PCI DSS earlier, and that's a key area where we get used in compliance. So we've started to branch out into many, many different types of solutions on top of this really, really flexible engine that we have.
Well, it does give you unprecedented visibility into exactly what's happening on the network. Which,
absolutely.
Yeah, and that was the thing that most impressed us at Interop. Let me be honest here. When Wildman first came to the network, he was just another guy screaming at us to give him all the logs. We're like, whatever. But after we started seeing what it could do, it was like, oh, yeah, okay, no, we want to do this. And we've got some great stories, which is why I want to bring my co-host back in just a bit. But first, let's take a break and thank the next sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Folks, there are a lot of different ways for you to get the message out about your company. You could do cold calls. You could have webinars. But all of them have their drawbacks, and all of them can be a bit daunting when you don't know what you're actually doing, which is why we're very happy to have Citrix GoToWebinar as a supporter of the Twiat Riot. You see, GoToWebinar understands exactly how to do it. They take all the best practices for presenting your messaging, your product, and they package it into one easy-to-use service. GoToWebinar lets you present to hundreds of potential clients with confidence, letting you connect and convert your target audience in one go. Now, here's how it works. You pick your topic, you select your audience, and you schedule your event. You were expecting me to say more, weren't you? No, that's it. It's really that simple. GoToWebinar does everything else with automated emails, custom branding, and practice sessions. Now, speaking of practice sessions, this is my favorite part of the product. Because as an IT person, I know the pain of trying to make a webinar or a conference call go well. All it takes is one person who doesn't quite get it, or one setup that's not quite right, and it slows everything down. It kills the presentation. So if your clients, if your interested parties can test beforehand so that when it comes time for the presentation, they can pay attention to you, your company, and your branding, well, that's a GoToWebinar. Now, if you've ever tried using unified communications, GoToWebinar is going to be your go-to tool whenever you want to present to a large audience. Of course, it doesn't stop with prepping your audience for the presentation. During the event, GoToWebinar will keep track of your audience engagement with interactive polls, live chat, and real-time feedback. And once the event is over, you get one-click registration, attendance, and performance metrics. In other words, you get something to show your boss to say, this is why we did the webinar, and this is how successful it was. Basically, GoToWebinar enables marketers like you to easily reach your target audience and turn leads into customers. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to get started with GoToWebinar today to connect and convert. Visit GoToWebinar.com to start your free 30-day trial. That's GoToWebinar.com for your free 30-day trial. And we thank GoToWebinar for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and bring my co-host back in here. I want to start with T-Bert, because T-Bert, there is in the annals of Interop lore, there was a time where one vendor, and I won't mention the vendor because what happens at Interop mostly stays at Interop. There was a vendor who was messing around with the power distribution units and just decided, hey, let's test what the shutdown all command did. And it shut down everything. It slammed the entire network. And he then went to say, it wasn't me. It must have been some glitch. Maybe someone else did it. But because Splunk was receiving all the logs, we were actually able to see exactly when and where and what login credentials were used to issue the commands to the PDU. Could you confirm that this actually happened and I didn't imagine it?
Actually, I was involved with that. It actually wasn't a shutdown all. What he did was right before the show floor opened, he decided, I'm going to do a firmware update. And he forgot that the firmware update reboots 100% of the PDUs it touches. So we had a power outage across the entire show floor because of a firmware update.
Because we know that the best time to run a firmware update is right before you do a show.
Yeah, and yes, we were able, he was basically saying, no, I didn't do anything, you know, I'm innocent. He actually started it and then went to lunch.
Right.
And we went through the Splunk logs and go, what happened?
Oh,
and
I remember that. Because right, he came back and he's like, I wasn't even here. How could it have been me?
Yeah.
Wait, Wildman, were you at that show, Wildman?
No, I was there, right? I did the search, right? Right? So
yeah.
And that dude denied it.
He did.
And actually, he came back, and I think it was Glenn, right? Glenn was running Interop. And, you know, naturally, when the whole show floor, especially, I think the biggest problem was that externals went down. Yeah. The first thing Glenn did, I swear, he was behind me, he points it, he's like, Splunk, what do you got? Like that. And so it was really simple. I just, you know, we looked at the time range and just sort of narrowed it down in about 10 seconds, and it turned out there are logins, and it was like, okay, who logged into this PDU or whatever it was? We saw the person's name, and then there was Hell Hath No Fury like an interop manager scorn. So, yeah,
The corollary to that story is it would have been okay if he had owned up to it and then bought the team beers. Because we've all, in fact, Chibert, you'll remember this. There was one other time that power was deprived of the interop knock and the entire show went down. who was the guy who did that? That was, that was me. I did that. That's right.
The light was going, but everybody was all pissed off because all the buzzers were going off and alarms.
Yeah.
So someone turned it off.
And I was told to turn it up. I was told by an engineer, those buzzers are really annoying. Could you please disconnect them? I'm like, okay.
Yeah, and nobody noticed that the light was going around on the UPS.
Yeah. Yeah, that was me. That was me. But I owned up to it. And I did buy a round, so it was okay. Yeah. No, but the funny thing is, you know, we don't talk about that much because we don't like shaming vendors at Interop. But I think for a lot of us, right then and there, like, okay, that if that happened in my network, that would make Splunk worth it. Above and beyond anything else that Splunk could do for my analytics, the fact that I can go back in time and see exactly what happened at a particular time and date that led to an event, that's worth its weight in gold.
So we have so many of these stories. Yeah. And I mean, I have a personal one from like I said, former life before I worked for the vendor. I worked for a telecommunications company who will not be named, but we had a complaint from the Better Business Bureau of one of the municipalities that we did business in. And they had claimed that one of our customer care reps had sent them some very defamatory text messages. And that was, you know, we were somewhat doubtful, but we had an exact copy of the message that had been sent to them. And so, you know, I was like, well, let's just check and see. And so logged into Splunk, typed in the exact text of the message that was sent. And sure enough, at that date and time, you know, there it goes. There. It was very, very incredibly embarrassing. But there's no hiding from the machine data exhaust. I mean, once it's there, it's there. It's out there.
The logs will save you. Let me bring in my other co-host, Lou. You've been watching the coolness. You've been watching the greatness. Where do you see this kind of tool being used, and why has Microsoft not bought Splunk yet?
Well, don't know that reason, but you know, there's always a room for these types of tools. I mean, being able to produce KPIs, especially like they were talking about, especially those executives that, you know, don't necessarily want to look at the data. They just want to look at the red light, green light, blue, you know, red light, green light, then yellow light type things, and to understand where things are at. These are in the data behind it. That's always important to be able to kind of show, hey, this is where the network is at, and this is where the security is at. Always good things. And, you know, there's a lot of, Microsoft has it, Google even has it, a lot of tools that attempt to do this, not at some of the depth that Splunk does, but, you know, they attempt to do this. So, and a lot of people take advantage of them. So that's kind of where the value is in this platform.
Yeah. Yeah. And, Hal, you've been relatively quiet in this discussion, although you've been very, very noisy in the chat room, which is fantastic. When you look at the solutions that are being offered by Splunk, and when you see them being presented to IT managers, how often do they actually get it? Do they understand what the value of the solution is?
I mean, there's a process, but yeah, you do wait for that light bulb. And there's many cases of where the team is doing a demo, and someone will maybe some a team of executives will say, you know, we'll be right back, and you see a couple of them running out of the room, and then they huddle, and then they come back in 3 minutes later, and it's like, where do we sign? So you know, it's definitely a case where it really depends on what you're trying to do. There's so many use cases, so. Sometimes you're going to get people who maybe they're not used to the tool, maybe they're not used to change, and there's a process, there's a comfort level type of thing. But we live in work in such a fast paced environment. It's pretty exciting, and getting to that aha moment, that light bulb was excellent.
Hal, I want to say that first of all, you were very pensive in that video feedback. It was fantastic. But also, you did mention in the chat room to Lou that. You are partnered with Microsoft. What's involved there?
We are doing some cool things with Microsoft. I'm not sure that there's anything I can announce at this point, but there are. I'll just say that it's known that Microsoft has presented at our user conference before. They do a lot of cool things with Splunk, and just watch the space.
Right. Cheebert, I do want to bring this back in because this is very germane to the conversation. You've been wanting to use Splunk for the longest time. For science, how do you see that working?
Well, my biggest problem is trying to convince these scientists that, yes, you can give up that piece of whatever's called Data Turbine. Data Turbine is almost 15, 20-year-old technology, and it's got to go. We need big data in science. We've got massive amounts of time series data, and it would be perfect for things like power monitoring, be perfect for things like engineering data coming off my underwater observatory, be perfect for environmental data that's scattered all over the Hawaiian Island chain. It'd be awesome. And Michael, Wildman actually got me a grant for a license, and they won't let me use it. It's driving me nuts.
Who won't let you use it? Wait, what?
My scientists. Oh. It's like they their management, they just don't understand that they need big data, and let's go use something that's a more intelligent implementation of big data.
Hey, Wildman.
Should I go visit them?
Yeah, go visit Hawaii. Yeah, I think that's necessary.
So. I don't have plans to go this year. Usually we're there in Maui every summer, so perhaps this is a reason to go to a different island.
Yeah, and now, actually, you do have quite a few uses in the sciences, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of people that use Splunk for a lot of different things. I can't talk about it because then I'd have to
kill
reveal
Clint.
My master plan. But it's silly the amount of stuff that people do with it. And you know, the other thing, I mean, I get Data Turbine is free. It's open source. Splunk is free too. I mean, but you know what? People are resistant to change. I can't blame them. So I'm happy to help wherever I can.
Actually, we are running out of time, but before we do run out of time, Hal, can you talk a little bit about the pricing schedule? Because that does scare people off. They think, oh, this is obviously a very expensive solution. It's an enterprise solution. But it's actually a lot more affordable than people might think. How do you do the pricing tiering at Splunk?
So like Wild said, it's free. There is a free tier of Splunk. The licensing is based on the amount of data that you index per day. So think about the logs, the metrics, the things that are output, all this machine data. You add it up, and however much that you're gathering into Splunk per day, the license is based around that. So under 500 megabytes a day, totally free product. Above that, that's when you're talking to sales and so forth. There is also a limited feature version of Splunk called Splunk Lite that starts in at a much lower level. I think you can get it in our cloud service offering for like $90 a month or something. So really, there's something for everybody.
And of course, 500 megabytes of logs is a fantastic amount of logs, just so you know. We couldn't get to the conversation about containers because we ran out of time, but that's actually good because it allows me to bring the Splunk team back at some point in the very near future. But Wildman, you did want to say a few things about Docker, right?
Yeah, just a couple of things. I became a customer recently, and I'm happy to talk about that. But one of the things that Docker and Splunk have partnered with each other is what's called the logging driver for Splunk. Now, a number of months ago, we released an
a way to get data in over HTTP, just a token, and from your app, you stream directly. No forwarder, no log files, none of that stuff. That's built into Docker now. So if you have a copy of Splunk, like the free one that you might download, you can set it up. And when an app runs in a container, provided its logs are available to Docker, and this is totally changing people's idea on how you even do logging, because to hell with logging to files anymore. Just literally log to the container. The container can stream directly to Splunk, and it's fantastic. It makes the footprint of all the software you have to deploy better. I mean, we're doing a whole lot of stuff with running Splunk in containers. We'll be at DockerCon this year. So if we don't come on Twiat before then, maybe we'll come on after. A whole lot of stuff going on. Tweet any of us if you want to talk about it or all that kind of stuff. So
fantastic. And yes, that will be the prime topic for the next time the Splunkers come on. Unfortunately, woo, folks, I'm sorry, but you have used up another hour of your time listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 logs. I want to thank all of our panelists for being here. This was a big show, and actually it was a lot of fun. Let's start with you, Clint, because you're in studio. If they wanted to find out more about what you do, about Splunk, about the work that you do to build things like Last Table, where would be the best place for them to go?
Well, so first of all, Splunk.com. You can try it out right on our website. Free cloud trial. We have a cloud service as well. Everything gets started right there. For me personally, you can catch me on Twitter at Clint Sharp or also on blogs.splunk.com.
Oh, thank you. And Wildman, you got to tell them about your podcast, because I think a lot of our people would be interested in what you talk about.
Yeah, we've been doing this podcast. We did a couple years ago. It was really fun. And we changed some staff and took a hiatus. But me, Hal, and Clint Truly, or Clint Sharp, right, is doing Splunk Talk again. And it's being broadcast live, similar to this show, but not as... We don't have a studio like that yet.
Well, your problem is that Hal's not using a PR40.
So, and those headphones aren't pretty. So we've got that going on, and it's nerdy, and there's a lot of talk about how to solve problems with Splunk, and even questions like, I mean, there are probably no three better people to literally explain how to do regexes on the planet than the three that are on Splunk Talk. So, you know, If there's nothing else, there's that. But
and where did they find that? Splunktalk.com?
Yeah, I think so.
just Google Splunk. Yeah, how's that website going there, buddy?
Just Google Splunk Talk. It's on YouTube, Splunk Talk. Twitter, Splunk Talk.
Okay. Yeah. The next time he comes on, he'll probably have a domain. I've heard.
Anywhere you find podcasts, you will find Splunk Talk.
Just heck with the domain. Just Google.
Okay. And Hal, what about you? Aside from Splunk Talk, which may or may not be found at SplunkTalk.com, where else can they find your work?
I am at Haller9000 on Twitter, and I have another podcast that I've been doing for 7 years with a good friend of mine, Power Scripting podcast, where we talk about PowerShell.
That's
something for some of you perhaps in the audience that are on the Windows side.
Actually, I've got some DevOps guys who would love to talk to you. How about that? Ooh. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Again, this has been a lot of fun, and we will have you on again. I'll get back with Michael right after the show, and we'll set a time because... This was great. And we did miss out on containers, and I'd love to have that discussion. Let's go back to our regular host. Let's start with Lou. Lou, you've been on, I think, 4 consecutive weeks as our second, and I want to thank you so very much for being here, especially with a new baby in the house. You are a busy, busy man, which is why you're delayed, actually, that you're so tired. Everything's kind of lagged. Can you tell the folks where they can find you?
Absolutely. You can always find me at LouMM on Twitter. And of course, you can always find my work that I do at Microsoft at crm.dynamics.com.
That's Lou Maresca. He's a senior lead over at Microsoft and one of my favorite people on the planet. Another one of my favorite people is Mr. Brian Chi, again, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, what can we expect from you in the coming week?
Don't know, but now that I've seen Wild Man and his gang of merry men talking about Splunk and all the cool things that have happened, I think I need to go and update my little freebie version of Splunk and get back to eating the learning curve.
Indeed. I'm all about the learning curve. Well, folks, that does it for this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I want to thank you so very much for joining us. Don't forget that you can go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. If you go there, you'll see our entire back catalog of episodes, as well as a link to subscribe. That's the best way to support the show. If you like Twiat, if you like hearing Enterprise goodness, if you want to get the show in the format of your choice on your device of choice, again, twit.tv/Twiat. Don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's the best place to find out what we're going to be talking about each week on every show, as well as to suggest topics and guests for future shows. Finally, thanks to everyone here at the Brick House who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and Leo for letting us do This Week in Enterprise Tech. To Carson, our super producer. To Brian Cranky Hippo Burnett, my technical director, who he's on the microphone right now. Yeah, Brian, you want to say hi to the folks at home?
So we do a how-to show every... Hey, you recognize guy behind me, right?
How about that? Wait, what's going on there?
So that's why we got to rush, because there's something going on right after this. But you can find me at Cranky_Hippo on Twitter, and we do a how-to show together called Know How.
How about that?
Raspberry Pi Security Cam coming up on Monday. Check it out.
Boom. Until next time, don't forget to stop by at live.twit.tv every Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific. And, of course, download the shows wherever fine podcasts are aggregated. I'm Father Robert Ballister, the Digital Jesuit, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.